just a stranger.
Welcome to The Art Scene, presented each week by UALR's College of Arts, Humanities and Social Sciences and UALR Public Radio. The 69th Arkansas Writers' Conference opens on May the 31st, and the keynote speaker is Deborah Mathis, well-known journalist, reporter with print and on television, the author of several books, her latest, Yet a Stranger, Why Black Americans Don't Feel at Home, a regular participant in television news talk shows and active as a public speaker. A Little Rock native and Central High School graduate, I wanted more of her background and wondered if she was always interested in writing and in public affairs.
Always. I mean, as a little girl, several years in a row, I won't say every year, but several years, I produced a little neighborhood play, a kind of a little variety show. I wrote music as a kid. I wrote poetry. My father kept a whole book of poetry that I had written. So always the writing was a part of me as long as I can remember. I was really blessed to have come from a very literate home. My parents were both college educated. They loved the classics, both in poetry and in literature. And there was a lot of reading, a lot of storytelling, a lot of analogies in my household. So, the words were precious and plentiful in my household. So I think that was part of it. But I also think that I was kind of born with some drive to write.
Yeah. Now, you went to Central High. What dates were you there?
I graduated in 1971, 68-69 school year to 71.
So you were a good 10 years or more off the actual crisis, but did you find that you were comfortable, that you had the teaching and the encouragement at school as well as at home?
Yes, I did, amazingly. Even though it was a decade after the crisis, two things. One, there was still a lot of work to be done by the time I had gotten there. There were still kind of two separate parallel universes, you know, black and white. In fact, while I was there, I was one of the founders of the first black student union, which I think is still a part of Central High. I don't know, maybe not by now. But for many, many years, I know it was still active. Because the next stage of the movement was kind of, first, its access, and then its inclusion and real integration. And so by the time I was there, the whole movement was trying to get black achievement, black sensibilities recognized, you know, after the first wave that just got in the door.
Right. Now, were there two student newspapers, for example?
There was one student newspaper, and I was the editor of it in my senior year. Charles Lance, the late Charles Lance, was an amazing trailblazer in journalism education. And his students, including me, his proteges, won national awards just regularly. I mean, Rick Sellers, me, there were a lot of us who were nationally recognized under the tutelage of Charles Lance. So this man had a bigoted bone in his body. I'd be surprised, because I was black and I was female, and he named me editor of the paper that year, the first black and female to be editor of the paper, and we went on to just sweep the country in terms of high school journalism, you know. It was a wonderful experience. What I was going to say, too, about the Central High crisis is that I was fascinated with that from my childhood. I'm just almost obsessed with it. I couldn't believe something so dramatic and so incredible had happened in my own hometown. And I learned about it really the day that the Civil Rights Act of 64 passed, and all of the grown-ups were just abuzz and jubilant and talking. And I asked, you know, what's going on? And my parents tried to tell me, and then my mother pulled from a closet a box, like a shirt box full of newspaper clippings from the Arkansas Gazette that were contemporaneous to the crisis. And she told me, this is what this is about. And I went through those clippings, I don't know how many times a year throughout my youth. I was just so fascinated with it.
Mm-hmm. Have you read any of the books that came out of that marvelous nine?
I think I've read them all.
There can't be many countries with a group like that to help solve a national crisis.
And I wouldn't say amazing. Aren't they amazing? I mean, passed on. And, of course, Daisy Bates and Elsie Bates, they're both long gone. But what an amazing group of people. But, you know, that's kind of the way destiny works. I mean, it doesn't choose just anybody. And I think that although they were they're very different in their personality types and in their kind of life trajectories and all, they all shared in common this real courage and mm-hmm. this real sense of, I mean, how precocious can you be to be that young at a time when your life is literally in danger and you still step forward to do what has to be done?
Yeah.
That's amazing.
When you went off to D.C., I was curious to know, you went as a journalist paid for by the Gannett Company?
Correct.
Read your articles. You wrote for the Arkansas Times quite a bit, too, didn't you?
I started a newspaper in 1971, right out of high school. I got a newspaper job. I put college on the back burner, and here all these 40-something years later, still on the back burner, and went to work in the field that I was going to go to college for. And then I got an opportunity to go into television at a time, again, coming out of the civil rights movement, the Kerner Commission report, where, you know, one of the recommendations was that all television and radio stations and newspapers diversify, you know, their staff. And so I was kind of at a premium. Here I was, one of the rare black journalists anyway. I was green as could be. Charles Kelly, then the news director at Channel 11, felt the weight of the Kerner Commission mandate and the weight of, I think, just real social justice, and kept bugging me about coming over to television. And I just had no thought of that. But he was so persistent, I decided to give it a try. I went into it, hated it, thought I was really awful at it, but knew I couldn't turn around and quit right away. So I thought, okay, I'll give it a year. That'll look decent, and then I'll go back to print. And then by then, a television station in Washington had called me and asked me to come to work in the nation's capital in television. So I spent 15 years in television before I got really tired of not being able to do long-form journalism anymore and quit by that time from Channel 7, back in Little Rock and Channel 7, and went to the Arkansas Gazette as a columnist. And again, a first. There had never been anyone my age, I was then in my late 30s, black or female, to write on the editorial page of the Arkansas Gazette. I did that kind of on a contract basis for a while and then was hired on staff and was associate editor of the paper. And then we all know it folded. I left there, went to another Gannett paper as a staff columnist in Mississippi, spent 1 year there, and then Gannett decided to staff the White House beat because Bill Clinton was coming in. Everybody was excited, and they wanted someone, as most news organizations do, who knew the new president, and they brought me to Washington. So that's how I went from print to broadcast and back to print again.
And you've been in print most of the time since?
Yes.
Now, you've been in various places and jobs since as well that are delightfully diverse. I have been wondering how you went from that and your approach, and I'm fascinated to read that you were driven to cover and then write a piece that was on a conference on the 2000 election in Boston, I believe it was.
I like kind of new challenges. And at 2000 convention, I just felt, okay, I'm ready to do something new now. And I can't explain why this has happened to me occasionally. It happens less often now, the older I get, but it still is in me. And I just started looking around and found out that there was Helen Thomas had been named the new fellow for the Shorenstein Center for Press Politics and Public Policy at the Kennedy School at Harvard. And for whatever reason, Helen decided that she couldn't take that fellowship. So it opened back up right around the time that I was just kind of tooling around. And I applied for it and got it. So I quit my job at Gannett, and I spent a year as a fellow at Harvard. We had to produce a case study, and mine was on race and the 2000 election. And I think I took a really novel approach to it. It got a lot of attention. To really cap it off, I got President Clinton to make his first post-presidential domestic speech. If you remember, right after he left office, he was going around the world kind of making speeches, but had not done any in the U.S. yet. So this was in June of 2000, and I convinced him to be the keynote speaker at the conference in which my case study was presented. And that was just a great victory and a great day, and everything went well. And then after that, I just started, again, looking around at different things, and I've been literally all over the world because of it.
At that particular point, was that when your first book came out, or had you already written books before that time? Because it seemed to me that that period of time would have just been full of possibilities for a book that would draw upon what you felt and were working toward in terms of letting people know things that weren't often in the public eye.
Yes, I had written one book by that time, and the other two came after I left the fellowship. And I have yet to write a book about me, really, about my life, except for, you know, little pieces here and there in the book. Your life has been so unusual. That's a nice way of putting it. You know, I can't believe you haven't written a book. I don't know why I would. I have to figure out why I should do that. Who? There has to be some more compelling motive. Force behind. I haven't landed on that yet. What can I really bring to anybody? There are lessons for sure to be learned from both the great things that have happened and the bad things that have happened in my life. But, you know, I'm not presumptuous, and I'm not, I don't have the ego drive to just say, hey, look at me. Mm-hmm. But there has to be something higher than that. I haven't found that yet.
Well, you implied at the very beginning of this conversation in your passion for writing, and presumably the writing was spurred by the ideas you wanted to put on paper. And by that time, you weren't of an age or of an experience to have anything that you felt worth reading for anybody else. You know, you had to build up the repertoire. But at this point, it sounds as though you've still got such a reservoir of ideas to write about that you can pick and choose without bothering about a book about yourself. And yeah. So these other jobs you've done in Istanbul, then the Northwest University Medill School of Journalism, media consultant for Africa Trade, Public Justice Foundation, director of communications, these all came at a time when you were ready for them. Were you approached, or did you look at something and think, oh, that might be rather fun, I'll see if I apply, what happens?
The latter. I mean, again, it's my sense of adventure. Mm-hmm. You know, I've always said it's really a great thing that I, you know, have three children. They probably have kept me from being, you know, the world's greatest dilettante. Just a single woman out here, I swear. I mean, I'd be all over the place doing all kinds of spur-of-the-moment things. I just like that kind of living.
You haven't signed up to go to Mars yet.
No, I'm still earthbound and very much committed to remain on the earth.
That was Deborah Mathis, who will be the keynote speaker at the 69th Annual Arkansas Writers Conference, which will be held May 31st through June the 1st, 2013, in Holiday Inn Presidential, 600 Interstate 30. For more information, call Janice Kearney, 501-772-2930. Now, a rundown of some events this week. See Warhorse at the Walton Arts Centre in Fairfield today, last day for the outstanding show. And also today in Little Rock at Trinity Episcopal Cathedral, the fourth of four Sunday chamber music concerts at four, mezzo-soprano Suzanne Losch with cellist Stephen Feldman and pianist Naoki Hakutani. At Murray's Dinner Playhouse, Steel Magnolias. Saline County's Shakespeare in the Park presents The Tempest in Tyndall Park Outdoor Auditorium, 7 p.m. May 30th through June the 1st and June 6th through 8th. For more information on the arts, visit our online calendar at ualrpublicradio.org. In 2013 is the 18th season for the Hot Springs Music Festival, and the occasion is being dubbed Coming of Age, given the importance the 18th birthday holds in the lives of most Americans. For this celebration, the two people most responsible for putting the show together have chosen to join the rest of the Western musical world to celebrate the 100th birthday of English composer Benjamin Britten and the 200th of Italy's Giuseppe Verdi and Germany's Richard Wagner. So, Festival Music Director Peter Bay and General Director Todd Cranson joined me a few days ago to highlight some of the programming in this year of the Titans.
The looming bicentennials of two extraordinary composers, Verdi and Wagner, and a centennial composer, Britten. And how are we going to combine these three? They have something in common, which is opera.
Was there any rivalry between you so that by the time you'd put it all together, one particular composer had got the lion's share of programming?
It's interesting because Verdi wrote nothing for symphony orchestra outside of operas, opera preludes or overtures. There's a string quartet by Verdi, but there are no symphonies by Verdi, no tone poems. Wagner, you have arrangements or chunks of instrumental interludes from various operas and overtures. Britten, there's lots to choose from. But I think maybe overall the leaning is towards no one because we found lots of arrangements of arias and melodies from various operas arranged for flute and piano or clarinet and piano, maybe even brass.
Yeah, I did lean heavily in the brass direction, but Peter kept us all in check.
Seemed looking at the printout of the program, you start with a bit of Verdi and you end with Verdi, and there looks like a bit of Verdi in between. So it seemed to me that he is probably the most listenable to of all three major composers. But they're all so different. So you couldn't say, well, we've had enough of that, we'll go on to something else. With Benjamin Britten, the more you listen to him, the more melody there is in his works. And you suddenly realize why. Now, he is so much more popular than he was then.
The other two, of course, Wagner and Verdi, were romantics through and through, and our opinion of them has not changed. I think, but Britten's, we have changed our opinion on him.
So now we come to the works that you did choose. Why and how did you, in all that wealth of material to choose from, come up with something that would speak to what the Hot Springs Music Festival is there for and will enrich the programming, the apprentices coming, the crowds coming, in a way that to celebrate your 18th anniversary would be appropriate?
That's quite a question. I think one of the things we looked for was variety. And since the festival is primarily the one of chamber music with orchestral concerts in between. In the case of Britten, it seemed like we were going to choose lots of chamber music, and there was lots to choose from. We have a work for pipe organ. We have a work for solo oboe. And we wanted to play something from his most famous opera, Peter Grimes, which is why I selected the 4C interludes, which is also a wonderful piece to play with a young orchestra. There's energy in it, there's anger in it, there's a lovely reflection in it, and has all the kinds of qualities that, any musician of any age can learn from.
It's so programmatic, it's almost a cliche to call it programmatic. The exquisite opening, the real stormy weather that I don't think has been matched by anybody writing Storm at Sea, even Wagner and the Flying Dutchman. I think that that Storm at Sea interlude that Benjamin Britten has written is spine-chilling.
It really is. I mean, it's kind of a successor to La Mer. There's a wonderful storm scene in La Mer, too. But I think the fact that it is a more contemporary-sounding storm, somehow we relate to it more than the usual just go up a chromatic scale like Liszt might have done, or maybe even Wagner, for that matter.
But England has, Britain has a very, very rocky coast.
Indeed.
And storms that batter the island, Benjamin Britten's music catches it.
Indeed. In fact, I went to England. I went to Aldborough to make a pilgrimage to where Britten lived. And in the opera Peter Grimes, there's something called the Moot Hall. And I had no idea that this was actually a real edifice. It's right on the shore there. And it was a winter day when I was there, and I can certainly understand how Britten was able to just stand out there, perhaps, and get the flavor of what was going on.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
And it's all in his music.
Well, I'm delighted you've got that particular episode in his career. But they've also got, and I don't remember them, the Metamorphoses of Ovid.
Right, for solo oboe. I forget for whom it was written, but there are six short movements. They all have such great character. They're short movements, but in each one you get a flavor of what each metamorphosis was.
And you were talking about, you know, how did we decide on these things for the festival? Well, from the practical and educational standpoint, we've done something like this before, but our oboe apprentices and mentor are going to divide out the six movements in each performance.
Oh, I wondered about this.
So the entire oboe studio will be performing that piece just one at a time. And the same goes for quite a few of the chamber orchestra pieces, not that they will be split up like that, but thinking about our apprentice musicians that are on the cusp of professional careers and giving them opportunities. Peter, just a story I didn't even share with you. I'm working on part assignments now yesterday, and one of the clarinetists wrote in to the clarinet mentor and said, you know, I'll play anything you want, but please put me in Siegfried Idol.
Uh-huh.
You know, so Peter brings this brilliance of musical programming to figuring out exactly what we're going to do. And I keep one foot in practical world there and just thinking about what's going to be good for our students. I was a teacher before I got this job. And so that's kind of how the whole thing came together.
I'd get back to mentors. How many mentors now have become mentors that were apprentices first?
Oh, that's a great question. Well, I am one.
I know.
Our former clarinet mentor, who is taking a leave of absence this year, he was the second to return. That
may be it.
It right now. Off the top of my head, no. However, it's great fun to keep in touch with mm-hmm. all of these former apprentices and things. And we have an associate ensemble in residence that will be there this year. It's a piano trio named Canadae.
I saw that,
and
yes.
And they met at the 2010 Music Festival. Two of the three of them enjoyed performing together, have kept it up and continued, and now formed this piano trio and have had a great start to their career as a trio, and they will be here for the 2 weeks and performing on our opening night, as well as doing a full-on recital on June 13th.
Where do they get the name? Is that the name of one of the players?
No.
That's a terrific question. We're about to find out the answer to that. I believe it's a Japanese name.
It is a Japanese name, and I could read you the very eloquent that they gave to me in the program book. The name Canadae was inspired by the Japanese verb Canadae Ru, which means to express one's spirit through music. Canadae, as a piano trio, strives to create a musical atmosphere that resonates with and communicates to the core emotions of their audience, offering the most personal experience possible.
Very nice. Britten, in this third day, you've got Verdi on the first at the opening of the whole festival. And I wanted to ask you about winner of the Dallas Symphony's competition for a horn player.
One of our opening fanfares, yes. Brian Sadler is a composer who I do not know yet, but I do look forward to talking with him and meeting him. This fanfare is something that I stumbled across, and it's just a wonderful one-minute fanfare, and to me it sounds like video game music. As I looked more into his background and everything, come to find out, he writes music for video games.
As I say, it must have been quite... How did you put it together? Because you've got so many concerts and you've got so much available to the public to go to in rehearsals and things. You've got the progressive concert that was new last year, wasn't it? And now you've done something extra with the bathhouses that is, again, a slight variation, isn't it?
Yes. Last year, for the progressive concert, seemed like a great idea, but I had no idea it would be as successful as it was, and we had more people than we knew what to do with there. I mean, my estimate would be over 1,000 people there, and there was no way we could possibly get even a fraction of them inside the bathhouses for the concerts we had planned. So this year, we are going to alter the plan just slightly. It will still go just as it did last year, in that it will start on the south end of Bathhouse Row and progress north, and the audience will move from location to location where the free outdoor performances are offered. And when we get to the plaza between the Fort Ice and Maurice bathhouses, we will have a brass ensemble short performance, as we did last year, except from there, we're going to do something new this year. The Natural State Brass Band from here in Little Rock will offer a 45-minute concert on the Stevens Balustrade, which is up near the promenade right there by that plaza. And then simultaneously, inside three of the bathhouses, we will have indoor concerts. And those three indoor concerts will be ticketed. People will need to buy tickets in advance because we can only accommodate about 50 to 75 people in each bathhouse. So it will be a truly intimate, delightful chamber music experience. But then for the mass crowd that chooses not to buy a ticket, we will have the Natural State Brass Band performing a free concert outside.
And there won't be any conflict of sound bleeding from one into the other?
Well, there might be, but it's a festival. It's as fun. I don't think that it will be of any real significance. My wife and I are renovating one of the bathhouses right now, and as our architect said, they're not going to blow away. They're made of solid concrete. So if there is any sound penetration, it will be very small, and I think in the fun atmosphere that this event is, it won't be any problem.
Are you renovating it to live in it or to hold it possible for future festival activities?
We are renovating it to open up a brewery and distillery in Hot Springs National Park.
Ah, what will you call it?
We'll call it the Superior
Festival
Bathhouse
Beer.
Brewery and Distillery, and it actually has nothing to do with the festival.
So you won't, at this point, know particularly whether it's going to be Wagner, Britten, or just special?
Inside the bathhouses, the repertoire is set, and it is on our website at hotmusic.org. Mm-hmm. You can click on the June 8th and see the program inside each of the bathhouses, so you can choose what you want.
Do the crowds seem to be growing?
They do. Especially some of the specific things we have done to reach new audiences, I think that they are starting to take root and work. The progressive concert I anticipate this year will be larger than last year. Last year we had Rick Robinson as Mr. Cut Time doing classical revolution style performances in restaurants and unsuspecting places, and people that he met in those places ended up coming to concerts. We've put a real push out to younger audiences, working with other organizations that specifically attract young audiences. And I know in the time since last year's festival, I have a lot more volunteers and people that are getting involved who are younger audiences. So we're making good steps towards building new audiences.
The Hot Springs Music Festival, General Director Todd Cranson and Music Director Peter Bay. The 18th birthday celebration season gets underway next Sunday, June the 2nd, with a traditional opening fanfare on the Arlington Hotel terrace, and the festivities continue from there till June the 16th. Visit hotmusic.org for details on rehearsals, free, tickets for events and festival passes, or call 501-623-4763. And that concludes this week's program. Please join us next weekend at the same time. I'm Ann Nicholson. Thank you for listening.
The Art Scene is a presentation of UALR's College of Arts, Humanities, and Social Sciences and UALR Public Radio.